Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Andrew Sloan, Assistant Professor of History at Baruch College at the City University of New York, and he's here to talk to us about his new book, The Jewish Revolution in Belarusia, Economy, Race, and Bolshevik Power, published this year by Indiana University Press. Andrew, thanks very much for joining us on New Books in Jewish Studies.
Thank you very much for having me, Max, and it's a pleasure to be here.
Fantastic. So the traditional first question on New Books in Jewish Studies, how did you come to write this book?
Well, I would say it was sort of a circuitous process. I've been interested in Russian and Soviet history for a very long time now, I think starting back when I was in college and first read Dostoevsky in a literature class, and it was has been a downward slide since then. But I think that I came to the specific question of Jewish history in Belarusia, again, through literature, really through reading Isaac Babel and through reading Yiddish literature produced in the Soviet Union in the 1920s. And when I started in graduate school at the University of Chicago, I knew that I wanted to work on the history of Jewish radicalism in the Russian Empire and the history of Jewish socialism. But at first I was convinced that I was going to work in the area of intellectual history in some form or another. And it was really when I had spent a summer in Eastern Europe, in Lithuania and other parts of Eastern Europe, doing pre-dissertation research and spending time also at the Vilnius Yiddish Institute. And I, after spending time in the archives in Vilna, I ended up going to Minsk on something of a lark and spending 2 weeks there, really because my reason for going there initially was the only thing I really knew about Minsk was that one of my favorite writers, Moishe Kulbach, had gone to Minsk in 1928 to take part in the process of Jewish Yiddish cultural reconstruction. And so I went to Minsk and I was there for 2 weeks in the archives. And the first archival file that I called up, I remember, was a file on from the Commissariat of Enlightenment talking about anti-religious campaigns in the Jewish community. And it was quite eye-opening to just sit there for a while and leaf through this file and see just page after page of reports about events that were going on in the Jewish community and the way the party was trying to structure these events and the people who were participating in them. And after 2 weeks of doing research and just calling up file after file and seeing all of this rich material, I knew that this was the place that I wanted to focus on. But I have to say that the specific project came out really from as I think most projects that begin as dissertations, from the insight and input of my dissertation committee, who all really just encouraged me to pursue the project in very specific ways. So I really have to thank Richard Helley, who was the first person who really sort of encouraged me to pursue Jewish history in the context of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union in general, the late Richard Helley. And then my advisor, Leora Auslander, who just sort of encouraged me throughout to push the boundaries of traditional Jewish history. And Sheila Fitzpatrick, who became my go-to person on Soviet history and who really encouraged me to think about what the archive in Minsk showed me about the social history of this place. And finally, Moishe Pistone, who always encouraged me to try to place this story that I was telling about the specific phenomenon of Jewish social transformation in Belarusia in a broader context of the social and economic transformations of the global economy in the 1920s.
That's brilliant. So first off, you can maybe you could sort of set the scene for us in terms of what the book tackles by giving us some of the historical background to Belarusia and the Jewish community there before the revolution. And maybe if you also wanted to outline some of the major claims and arguments of your study before we sort of dive into a chapter by chapter look.
Sure. Well, I think what is interesting about Byelorussia in the context of Soviet history is the fact that this was one of the few places, including parts of Ukraine as well, but really one of the places that was a center of Jewish life in the Pale of Settlement. It was a center of religious life, of Jewish demographic concentration throughout the period of the late Tsarist era. This was a region that was originally part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth and was taken over by the Russian Empire during the partitions of Poland at the end of the 18th century. And this was what struck me as being unique about this place is that in many respects, it was betwixt and between this old Polish republic and the Russian Empire, and then this new experiment in Soviet social transformation that emerged after the revolution. And Byelorussia in general was the Jewish population in Byelorussia was quite unique insofar as Jews constituted a rather large percentage of the population, particularly the urban population. They, according to the 1926 census, they constituted about a little over 8% of the general population of 4 million people. So there are about 400,000 or so plus Jews living in Byelorussia in total, or in the Soviet Republic of Byelorussia in total. But they formed frequently either majorities or pluralities, and sometimes quite large majorities, in the major urban centers. So they constituted over half of the urban population as a whole. They constituted majorities in cities like Mosir and Slutsk and other places. And in Minsk, the capital, by 1926, they accounted for about 42% of the population. And so this was a place that where Jews were concentrated, and not only were Jews concentrated, but they also had a long history of social strife within the community. So what I try to do in the book is to examine the ways that the revolution rather unexpectedly opens up a certain space for a real radical transformation of Jewish social, political, cultural, and economic life that is frequently characterized as in some sense being implemented from above by the Soviet state. But what I try to show in the book is that really this is a process that has a long history in these Jewish communities and is being driven in all of these small towns and cities of Byelorussia from participants at the local level who engaged in the Bolshevik project in one way or another, for out of conviction or opportunism or for a whole variety of reasons, as one can imagine, but ultimately engaged in the process of transforming not only Jewish society, which they did radically, but really played a critical role in the establishment of Soviet power in general in Byelorussia. So one of the big claims of the book is to bring that story to the forefront and to really emphasize the fact that this was a process of Jewish cultural reconstruction that was driven by people within the community, that this was not simply a state down driven process, and that it was from the outset was driven by groups that had been traditionally marginalized in the Jewish community. So particularly I spent a lot of time in the book thinking about artisans and Jewish artisans, whether in particularly in the quote unquote Jewish industry. So in the leatherworking industry, the textile industry, the tailoring industry, woodworking and so forth, and the way that they become key cogs in the process of Sovietization and Bolshevization, really. So that is one of the big claims of the book and one of the stories that I follow. And then one of the other stories that I follow is specifically the process of Jewish engagement with the party and the Bolshevik party, because Jews enter into the Bolshevik party and they enter in rather significant numbers particularly in the early period of after the revolution. And they play a critical role in helping to establish Soviet power in the region. And in some ways, I would say the revolution in Byelorussia is kind of unthinkable without the role that Jews, particularly in particular, a lot of Jews who had previously been members of the Jewish Socialist Bund, which was the largest Jewish socialist party in the Pale of Settlements, played in in supporting and ultimately helping to build this socialist experiment. And then the final claim that I think is critical to the entirety of the book is that this process of what I call the Jewish Revolution is obviously structured by politics and by the politics of both the party and the state and the internal politics of the community. But it's also very much structured by the economic limits and possibilities of socialist society in general. So the book really focuses on it's a history of Jews within the Soviet Union, but it's also a history of Soviet society in this period. And it examines the way in which these repeated economic crises that continually recur throughout the 1920s begin to restructure the way not only the Soviet state is dealing with Jews at a social level, but also discourses about Jews over the course of the 1920s. So I spent a lot of the book thinking about the way that economic crisis leads to a certain type of public conversation about the place and the role and identity of Jews within post-revolutionary society.
Great. So we're going to delve into all of that a bit further. So we'll start with your first chapter, which is titled Making Jews Bolsheviks. And here you look at Jewish radicalization at the grassroots level in the early years of the Bolshevik Revolution. Tell us a bit about this.
Well, yes, I sort of structured this chapter by thinking, first of all, about a series of reports I found, rather extensive reports, volumes really, about the 1921 purge in Belarus. And this purge was quite interesting. It was not a purge as we think of in the 1930s, where it sort of conducted clandestinely behind closed doors. So this is the purge in 1921 was a rather open process where in every party cell, there were public meetings where people basically discussed their personal history and their biographies. And so what these purge records provide are written biographies by people who joined the party. So I use these written biographies to think about the motivations and the various motivations that led Jews to enter into the party over the course of the revolution, and to really trace the process of radicalization at the grassroots level. And I think when we look at the relationship between Jews and the revolution, the date that really sticks out in a lot of people's minds is 1917, the Constituent Assembly elections after the Bolshevik Revolution, where Jews in Belarus and in Minsk in particular vote overwhelmingly for what's called the Klal Yisrael bloc, which is a bloc of sort of general Zionists and non-Zionists, but one might call traditional Jewish national politics, who dominate in 1917. And usually this is taken as a sort of indication of Jewish political identity over the course of the ensuing years. But what I try to show in the chapter is that that snapshot of 1917 is just radically transformed in Belarus in the ensuing years through, number one, the process of just political violence and war, because the war, the revolution takes place in 1917, but it spills over into first German occupation during World War I. And then in February of 1918, the Bolsheviks come back to power briefly in December of 1918. But then in the summer of 1919, Belarus is overrun by the Polish army of the newly reestablished Polish state in the period of the Polish-Soviet War. And it's not until 1920 when the Red Army reestablishes power. And what I saw in these purge records was the profound effect that the processes of occupation under initially the Germans, but really under the Poles in the period of counter-revolutionary violence played in radicalizing populations that previously had been quite, one might say, moderate or conservative in their politics. And what I tried to trace in that chapter is the story of predominantly young Jews, and these are people, I think the average age is 25 and under of the people who are really joining the party. And some of these are people who had longer standing ties to specifically Jewish political groups, whether it was the Bund or Poalition, the Socialist Zionist Party, or the Mensheviks, or other parties. But over the course of the war and the revolution, they begin to gravitate towards the Bolsheviks because of the belief that the Bolsheviks are the ones who are fighting the counter-revolutions and also pogromist violence. But to a large degree, these are people who are really coming of age politically during the whole revolutionary process. And there are a lot of young people who are bound up in the revolution and who go off and fight in the Red Army and participate in many different ways. So that by 1920, after the Civil War, when the Bolsheviks have established power, you have this group of Jewish radicals who play a critical role in establishing both party and Soviet institutions. And just to sort of put this into context, when the Bolsheviks retake Minsk in July of 1920, there's only about 100 communist party members in the entirety of Belarusia. Right? So this is a party that is very much in need of support, and they're looking around for support. And they look and they find the group that on the ground looks like the closest approximation to the proletariat in whose name the revolution had been made, which is the Jewish working class. It's not a classical working class in the sense of the kind of ideal type of blacksmiths and proletarian metal workers that one finds in a place like Petersburg. But the Jewish working class is overwhelmingly an artisanal class, and so these are artisans who are, again, woodworkers, tailors, and these types of individuals who are, for the large part, if they had pre-revolutionary political leanings, they were Bundists. And so a large number of Bundists enter into the party between 1917 and 1920, to the point that there's a debate over how many exactly, but somewhere along the lines of 300, I estimate that number is quite underestimated. Probably closer to 400 former Bundists enter into the party, and they enter in and provide a real sort of steadying presence in the party. And so what I try to show in the chapter, particularly I end the chapter by focusing on a particular set party cell, which is the party cell of the Yevpartschkol, which is the Jewish party school, which was a very unique party cell insofar as it was a specifically Jewish institution that was formed to educate workers and Jewish workers in the early Bolshevik period. But I use the party biographies to give a sense of the profile, a composite profile of these people who have joined the party and who are participating in this debate. And again, many of them are young. They tend to be, you know, bilingual, politically active, and extremely convinced of their political bona fides as Bolsheviks, precisely because of the fact that a whole large number of them had been Bundists and had been loyal Bundists. And so in this party cell, there are about 40 members in the party cell, 27 of them had been former Bundists. And so what I show in this chapter, I think, is a process whereby Jewish society is being radicalized, but the groups who are really being radicalized into the Bolshevik Party are people who came distinctly in a large percentage are people who came from distinctly Jewish politics in the first place.
Great. So you then discuss the discourses around speculation in Belarusia. What was speculation, and how did discourses around it function for different purposes and different groups?
Yeah, speculation was a really interesting crime insofar as it remained pretty much undefined through the early period of the 1920s. And it was used as a sort of catch-all phrase to discuss practices that were seen as being what I call, I think at one point, sort of tongue-in-cheek, unkosher forms of trade in the early Soviet period. And this involved everything from selling goods at prices that were above state mandated prices in periods of monopoly, to the selling of goods that were understood as being contraband goods that had been under state monopoly. And particularly it comes to involve the process of buying and selling different forms of money in the early Soviet period. So why I thought speculation was a particularly interesting category to focus on, and in this chapter I really look at court records of people who are being policed for engaging supposedly in speculation. But what I used speculation really as a way to think about the way the Bolsheviks were thinking about the phenomenon of capitalism. And what I thought was interesting about speculation was that what you see, these anti-speculation campaigns, is that when the Bolsheviks talked about overcoming capitalism or trying to transform capitalism, I had the question, well, what does this mean on the ground? And what it meant on the ground in the context of Belarus was really policing trade and the market. And so I use the anti-speculation campaigns to establish a certain way that the Bolsheviks are thinking about the phenomenon of capitalism in general in a post-revolutionary society where the revolution has been made in the name of overcoming capitalism. And of course, but it turns out to be the case that a very large percentage of the people who are being arrested for speculation in this period are Jews. And they're Jews who a lot of them have been engaged in trade prior to the revolution. Jews make up, estimates of 3/4 to higher a percent of all private traders in the pre-revolutionary period. And that continues into the post-revolutionary period, particularly after the introduction of what's called the New Economic Policy in 1921, which is a period of market liberalization, where the Bolsheviks are, due to shortages and mass revolt across the country, they rather begrudgingly reintroduce market trade or something that looks like market trade across the Soviet lands, and they legalize trade, and Jews enter into these types of newly formed market relations. But in this world where there's still a deep suspicion of the market and a deep suspicion of trade in general. So what I show in the chapter is that particularly in periods of social crisis, and there's an inflationary crisis that begin there. Well, there's an inflationary crisis during the war, during the Civil War. And then in 1923, there's another massive hyperinflationary crisis where the problem of trade becomes acute because prices are going up, goods are not moving. And at this moment, there's these massive anti-speculation campaigns where Jews are largely being rounded up and being arrested for engaging in these practices that are in theory frequently legal, right? They've been legalized in the course of the revolution, but because of this sort of murky area in which trade resides in this post-revolutionary moment, they're being targeted as in some sense the capitalist class in post-revolutionary society. And then I move from the sort of courts and the actual legal prosecution and the arrests of these people to the public discourse that emerges around trade and speculation. And what I think is interesting in thinking about this is that if you look at the court records, Jews from all over the social spectrum are engaging in these forms of trade. So you have Red Army soldiers and you have officials and you have, party members who are engaging in these quote unquote forbidden forms of trade. But when it's constructed in a rhetorical sense in the newspapers, in cartoons, and in poems, and in the feuilletons that are written in this period, the speculators are always characterized as basically archaic Jews from the shtetl and rabbis and these old types who are unable to come to grips with the revolution. So there's this real dichotomy that opens up between the practices of anti-speculation policing and the discourse that emerges that I think reveals quite a bit about the this post-revolutionary ambivalence about capitalism, and as I sort of argue, ambivalence about Jews also, which continues throughout the 1920s.
So your next chapter discusses Jewish attempts to integrate into the working class and reform Jewish identity through the valorization of labor, and how these attempts ran into persistent economic limitations. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, well, this is sort of the twin to the other chapter. Insofar as the second chapter looks at the capitalists after the revolution, of the constructed capitalists, this is the chapter that really thinks about Jews as workers and Jews as proletarians. But again, the curious thing about Jews in this moment is that they're never really the Jewish working class never really fits into the canonical Marxist analysis of what the proletariat is. They're artisans. They're frequently self-employed, or they employ a few laborers, or they work for small shops. And they are, as artisans, or what are, they're really what are called cottage producers or kustari, they are in some ways rather liminal in relation to the working class, because traditionally these are people who would produce not for wages, but on orders and on specific requests from consumers. But in the period of the revolution, they are being really brought into new forms of social production, and particularly after the introduction of the new economic policy, they are critical for producing consumer goods in the period of the NEP. And we think of the NEP frequently as a market process and the legalization of trade. But what I really found to be quite fascinating here was the process. This is the fact that this is also a process of the legalization of production, of a different type of petty production. And Jews are critical to the establishment of these new social relations in Belarus, because they're producing all of the goods that in theory are going to be traded to the peasantry in order to make the NEP economy work. So they're being brought in rather for these real forces of social necessity that are brought forth in the process of the revolution. And yet at the same time, they remain liminal, because Jews constitute about 90% of all of the kustari, or the artisan producers in this period. And this continues a long trend in which Jews had been the primary artisanal producers in the region. But yet, as kustari, they were never quite seen as fully proletarian. Now, when they entered into state workshops, and when they were brought into larger units or larger institutions of production, and into the trade unions in particular, they did gain access to a sort of status of being part of the proletariat, and rather self-consciously so. But what I see over the course of the 1920s is that in moments of economic crisis, the Soviet state went about solving these economic crises in quite the same way that liberal capitalist societies solve these crises. When there are problems of overproductions of goods, when there's problems of basically overaccumulation of goods or overaccumulation of labor, the Soviet state responds by laying people off. And so there's mass unemployment that is driven by these crises in that emerge, particularly in 1923. But the crisis is interesting, because what it means is that it's not just that Jews are being thrown out of the state, it's not only that workers are being thrown out of these state institutions, but they're being thrown out of these larger workshops, and they're being given permission to basically become private small producers. So they become kustari. And these kustari are simultaneously inscribed in discursively as being Jewish. And so, and it's quite, what I find interesting about the kustari is that they're really, and kustar production in general, it's the only aspect of economic life in post-revolutionary society that comes under the direct control of the Jewish section of the Communist Party, which is an indication of exactly how Jewish these institutions were. So in moments of economic crises, these people who were formerly trade unionists and good proletarians and fully integrated members of the proletarianized workforce are thrown out of work into these small workshops and these artisanal workshops, where they become kustari. And insofar as they become kustari, they're also being reinscribed as basically being Jewish. And so there's this kind of spectrum that develops of what it means to be a proletarian laborer. And there's a direct relationship, I argue, between this category of proletarianness and a category of ethnicity. And in some sense, the more you're integrated into the Soviet economy in this period, the more you lose the stigma of Jewish ethnic identity. But once you're thrown out of work and you're reintegrated into these older forms of artisanal production, once again, Jews are being sort of understood and governed as essentially Jews in this moment. So I try to work out that spectrum of the relationship between labor on one hand and ethnicity on the other in the course of examining these rather flexible forms of labor that are emerging in the post-revolutionary period.
That's very, very interesting. The next chapter opens with a compelling account of a theatrical trial of the fictional character Boncha the Silent. Tell us about this and its relevance for your assertion that the project of Jewish cultural transformation was limited by imperatives of economic and social reconstruction.
Yeah, well, I love this trial. It's basically, it opens with this story that was in newspaper of this trial that it takes place in a workers' club where hundreds of people gather to watch this fictitious show trial of Bansha Schweig, Bansha the Silent, who is a fictitious character known to all Yiddish readers from Itzik Peretz, and it is it's a trial where Bansha is seen as basically the sort of Jewish everyman. He lives this horrible life. He's oppressed by everyone, and then in the Peretz story, he basically finally dies and goes to heaven, and he's put on trial in heaven for all of the things that he didn't do and didn't say during his life, and the fact that he never stood up for himself, and he's finally exonerated, and he's offered all of the fruits of the kingdom of heaven, and he basically asks for a buttered roll, to show the utter limitations of his conceptualization of what heaven might look like. And so I think that there's an interesting moment in which the Bolsheviks, when these Bolshevik, what I call sort of cultural reformers, or these participants in a process that I see as part of a Bolshevik Jewish Enlightenment, or what was known traditionally as the Haskalah, but in this case, the Haskalah in a very Yiddish sense, who are trying to appropriate these old forms of Jewish cultural production and to put them back into the public sphere, but in a Bolshevized form. And this is just one small moment in a whole process of attempted Jewish cultural reconstruction, where you have Jews who are particularly an older generation of Jewish radicals, particularly those who came from the Bund, who are very much committed to the construction of a new type of way of being Jewish in post-revolutionary society. And so they're trying to construct different rituals of Jewish behavior to replace traditional religious rituals. So they introduce things like the Red Bris, very famously or infamously, depending on your perspective, where circumcision is no longer the process of entry into the communal sphere, rather this type of christening where young Jewish babies are given up to the revolution and given appropriately revolutionary names, like Karl for Marx and so forth. And there's this whole attempt to construct a real cultural revolution and a new type of what David Schneer has referred to as a Soviet Yiddish culture. And I think that's absolutely true. But I think that in thinking about this in relationship to the old Haskalah, the Hebrew Enlightenment, the Hebrew Enlightenment was never simply about cultural reconstruction of Jews and making Jews modern and all of these things we think of in terms of the Enlightenment. There's also a very pronounced social dimension to it. Even going back to the old 19th century Haskalah reformers, many of them, David Friedlander and Noton Notkin and Hirsch Peretz and others, had an idea that Jews not only needed to be transformed culturally, but socially as well. And they needed to be productivized into productive labor. They needed to be taken out of the types of trade and petty trade practices that had characterized Jewish social life in these areas. And they needed to be transformed into productive laborers. And it's this aspect of the cultural Haskalah project that I sort of argue over the course of the chapter is the one that the Bolsheviks really end up taking up, particularly younger Bolshevik cultural reformers. So there's kind of a split, a generational split, as there are on many of these issues, between this older generation that really focuses on the cultural dimension of social transformation, and the younger generation that is in some sense concerned with the process of Jewish social integration into the revolution. And it is, but what I sort of argues that even that position is quite tenuous because it's tied again to the NEP economy and to the idea that Jews are going to be productivized in all of these networks that are established during the NEP to reestablish the Soviet economic life. And so they're brought into this process, these processes in a moment that is fleeting, because by the end of the 1920s and beginning 1927, 1928, the NEP in and of itself begins to malfunction and begins to enter into its sort of death spiral. And insofar as NEP goes down, all of those politicians who are and party members and Jewish party members who are also supporting cultural reconstruction in the moment of NEP are also going down as well. So I end the chapter by focusing on Avram Belin, who's the second head of the Jewish section of the Communist Party, the Yevsexia. And he is a real sort of proponent of this type of cultural transformation that is tied fundamentally to this idea of social transformation. And he rises up as basically a social transformer in the NEP period. And he's very concerned about improving the conditions of the Kustari in the countryside and in the cities and to focus on the cultural reconstruction of young Jews. And he is brought in and into power, and he rises up in the period of the NEP. And when the NEP goes wrong, he goes wrong with it, and he basically gets driven out and is ultimately accused of being a counter-revolutionary and an opponent of the party for doing precisely what it was that he was brought to Minsk to do and brought to power to do, which is to introduce this process of Jewish cultural and social reformation on the ground. So I look at in the chapter as a whole, I look at this relationship there between cultural production and social reconstruction in this utterly fraught period that is basically bordering on the verge of this creative period of the 1920s and the onset of the Stalin Revolution at the end of the 1920s.
So the next chapter is an examination of the Bolshevik anti-Bundism campaign. Tell us about this and its relevance for the trajectory of the Bolsheviks' nationalities policy more generally.
Yeah, well, the anti-Bundist campaign begins in 1926. And this is a moment where suddenly, the earliest missives are in 1925, but it's 1926 where the rubber hits the road. And the party begins to really police, not as they insist, it's not against Bundists specifically or individuals who had previously been part of the Bund, but against what they understand as the spirit of Bundism that continues to dominate in party cells. And what Bundism means is that Jews are too interested in protecting their own trades and their own trade unions. They're interested in protecting their own trades. They overvalorize the history of the Bund itself. They are too committed to Yiddish educational projects and so forth. And so in 1926, the party circulates missives against the phenomenon of Bundism. And this leads to the direct policing of party cells at a local level, where these campaigns are brought into the party cells. And there are these political meetings that are held where people discuss the problem of Bundism. And what's interesting, I think, about this phenomenon is that the use of the concept of Bundism becomes a rather flexible term through which I argue really what's being discussed here is the issue of Jewish ethnicity in the course of post-revolutionary society, because Bundists are understood as those who are in some sense too aggressively promoting particular Jewish interests within the course of this general revolutionary milieu. So what is most important for my story is the fact that where these campaigns are taking place, and where they're focusing on worker cells. And so again, it's this process of trying to reconstitute not simply Jewish social life, but really a conception of what it means to be acceptably Jewish in the course of the post-revolutionary period. Whereas in the earlier period, Bundists were understood as in some sense being integrally tied to this project. By this period, there's obviously a massive turn and the emergence of a quite profound sense of ambivalence about the place of Jews in the revolutionary project as a whole. And this, I would say, becomes a way in which Jewishness, which in some sense has been the very idea of speaking about Jewishness and speaking about ethnicity, has become somewhat forbidden in the post-revolutionary period, because the Bolsheviks have outlawed anti-Semitism. They've insisted from the outset that Jews are part of the revolutionary project and they're to be integrated. And yet in this moment, there's this massive campaign that takes place across Belarus, which is effectively specifically targeting Jewish members of the party, as they quite clearly understand from the course of the evidence of the archival or the archival evidence of these meetings that are taking place in worker cells across the Republic in this period.
So you'd then move on to discuss the campaign around Trotskyism. Tell us about this and how it intersected with discourses of ethnicity and how it was structured by economic crisis.
Yeah, this is in some sense the mirror of the Bundism chapter, because insofar as what I think is interesting about the anti-Trotskyism campaigns is that they emerge after Trotsky is expelled from the party in 1927, and Trotsky and his followers. And there, between 1927 and 1928, there's this massive process of weeding out, again, a massive campaign to weed out Trotskyists and secret Trotskyist sympathizers in this period. And it becomes, and if you read it simply at the level of ethnicity, it is a very curious phenomenon, because something along the lines of 81% of the 320 some odd people who are identified as voting for Trotskyist positions in one vote or another across Belarus, of those, 81% are Jews. So it looks on some levels like it's a phenomenon of basically Jewish social or ethnic solidarity on some level. But what I started to see when I saw in the archive the breakdown of these people and sort of their profiles, they're not simply Jews. They're also workers of a very particular type. So overwhelmingly, these people are, again, leather workers, woodworkers, and textile workers, tailors and seamstresses, and these varieties of artisanal producers. And they are quite interesting to follow over the course of this campaign, because they make up the vast of these accused Trotskyists. And what makes them Trotskyists, or what makes them part of what's called the opposition, the United Opposition, initially has absolutely nothing to do with ethnicity. What they're angry about is the fact that they're workers in these small shops, and these shops are all being, in some sense, rationalized over the course of the onset, first the crisis of the NEP, and then the onset of Stalinist industrialization, where there's a turn, you know, on one level, there's a turn to industrialization, and there's the sort of rhetorical idea that they're going to modernize the Soviet economy at the end of the 1920s by building factories and mechanizing factories and these types of things that we sort of think of canonically as part of the Stalin industrial revolution of the late 1920s. But the primary way that they're rationalizing industrial production in this period, particularly in the small workshops and in these kind of manufactory areas, is by cutting wages and by slashing wages across and by freezing wages and in a moment of inflation, actually. So what is bringing workers in this moment into opposition with the government and or with not just the government, but the party as well, is precisely economistic questions in the 1926, 1927 period. And it happens to be the case that the industries that are most aggressively targeted for wage restriction are precisely those Jewish industries. And I would say they're targeted because they're consumer producing industries. And so it's not that they're punishing Jews. It's that basically these are goods that are understood as being necessary for industrialization and industrial society as a whole. And they're trying to prevent price inflation in these industries. And one of the ways they do this is to restrict wage growth. And so workers are angry about this, as workers in some sense always are when these types of phenomena happen. And they're organizing about it and they're criticizing the party. And in this moment of the anti-Trotskyist campaign, these types of criticisms come to be read by the party as basically being support for the opposition, because Trotsky by this point has in some sense reimagined himself as once again a sort of defender of worker interests. And so what begins as a rather, many of these people express hostility towards Trotsky himself. He had been a very vocal opponent of specific Jewish politics earlier in his revolutionary career. So they, but what they're expressing is in some sense a certain support for some of the policies that he's promoting in this period. But they get branded as Trotskyists and as supporters of the Trotskyist opposition. And then as the discourse unfolds over late 1928, particularly as the party begins to hold these meetings again in these party cells that are being targeted for Trotskyist opposition, which again are overwhelmingly worker cells. They're not targeting, you know, people who are in the cultural spheres and whatnot. It's a worker phenomenon. But in those discourses, workers themselves begin to sort of attack those supporters of the supposed opposition as basically being Trotskyists. And it tends to be the case that it's a lot of non-Jewish workers who are attacking Jewish workers as basically being Trotskyists. And they begin to sort of assert in this moment that the real reason why these people are angry in this moment is precisely because of ethnic or national solidarity with Trotsky himself. So what begins as a kind of economistic moment of worker anger that is driven by a crisis of a social crisis and an economic crisis comes to be reinscribed and reread at the local level, and then, as I argue, at the party level as a whole, as a phenomenon of ethnic solidarity and ethnic opposition. And so Trotskyism itself becomes in some sense inscribed as a certain type of Jewish deviation as well. And so this is, I think, rather critical to not only to the, again, it's not, this is not simply a story that is about the process of Jewish integration in this moment, but it really shows the way in which the Soviet story of high politics is being filtered down to the low faculty, the low factory level, and the ways in which local individuals are in certain sense interpreting the politics that are being driven from above, but they're not being driven necessarily by those politics from above.
So your last chapter is titled Anti-Semitism and the Stalin Revolution. Tell us about the campaign against anti-Semitism that accompanied the Stalin Revolution, and also if you could outline some of the conclusions of your book as a whole.
Yeah, well, the anti-Semitism campaign emerges rather not quite simultaneously, but slightly after these anti-Trotskyist campaigns, and there's a lot of overlap between them. And it really starts in Belarus, and really for a lot of the Soviet Union as well, because it became a sort of cause célèbre. But in November 1928, there's a very infamous moment in Belarus in a glass-making factory where this one young Jewish woman, it's revealed in an expose that's written in a Soviet newspaper, has been exposed to systemic violence at the hands of some of her coworkers, and systemic anti-Semitic violence. And they're basically attacking her as a Jew in a factory where she doesn't belong, because the glassmaking factory had been a overwhelmingly Belarusian institution. Very few Jews worked there until the moment of Stalin and Stalinist industrialization, where the glassmaking factories, like all industries in this moment, are expanded and there's a massive attempt to productivize laborers in these factories. And they, in the process of trying to expand and productivize laborers, they're also bringing in new laborers. And in this moment, what that means is that they're beginning to turn to the shtetl, where they had never recruited laborers before. And they're bringing in increasingly large numbers of Jews into these factories that had been overwhelmingly Belarusian prior to this. And so there is this, the chapter sort of looks at the way in which campaigns against anti-Semitism are emerging, precisely because on one level, there's a massive grassroots upsurgence of anti-Semitism at the factory level across not only Belarus, but the Soviet Union in the 1928 and 1929 period. And you see this not simply in Belarus, but in really in Yuli Larin and others write about this in the moment itself. And what I try to think about in this moment is the way in which this upsurgence of anti-Semitism is tied to the breakdown of social relations and in the factory, and really the pressures that are generated by this demand to ever to expand production and to intensify production at the factory level, which is being read by workers as a certain type of abstract domination that's being implemented on them from above. And they're reading it as basically the work and the machinations of the state, which is frequently being read as being Jewish and being a sort of kind of in a conspiratorial fashion is being read as a certain type of Jewish domination that's being implemented on the working class as a whole. And that's in I would say the violence that is emerging on the factory floor is in some sense a displaced violence and of angry workers who are seeing their social position increasingly eroded as their wages are eroded, as the demand for their labor time is increased. And they're projecting that violence onto the most immediate objects they can find, which are these workers who are basically being brought into the factory in a process of integration. So I look at the way in which the state introduces this massive campaign against anti-Semitism, these anti-Semitism campaigns, which again target the factory floor. And what I argue is that the anti-Semitism campaigns were not simply a campaign against race hatred, although they were also that, but they were simultaneously a campaign that was effectively being used to productivize laborers as well. They were being used to in a certain way suppress or channel these types of angers and anxieties and impulses that were emerging from the shop floor at a time when the shop floor was being subjected to increasingly radical forms of social transformation. And so I see this anti-Semitism campaign and also the phenomenon of anti-Semitism as well as both being tied to this emerging moment of a new type of revolution that's emerging within the Bolshevik Revolution as a whole, which is the period of the Stalin Revolution, and try to make the argument that all of these cultural phenomena or these ethnic phenomena are simultaneously they can't simply be understood as manifestations of economic crisis, but they're fundamentally structured by this moment of economic transformation that's being unleashed by the Stalin Revolution. And so I think that if I sort of turn from that to the kind of big claims of the book, what I show over the course of these chapters, basically beginning with the process of revolutionary transformation that is just utterly, in some sense, inflected with what I call Jewish revolution, this process of Jews who are entering into the party, who are integral to Soviet institutions, party institutions, and whatnot. Over the course of the 1920s, they're in various ways, whether it's as Bundists or as Trotskyists or as speculators or whatnot or as Kustari, they are being in some ways inscribed in different moments as being in one way or another outside of the acceptable realm of Soviet practice and ideological practices and Soviet politics. And these are campaigns that are frequently exclusionary, but they're not simply exclusionary. They're also, in some sense, campaigns that are designed to inform Jewish workers about what it means to be properly Bolshevik. And so there's a process whereby from the beginning of the revolution to the end of the 1920s and the onset of the Stalin Revolution, Jews are being, in some sense, simultaneously integrated into Soviet society, but the cost of integration is in some ways this stripping away of all of these former forms of Jewish political and social life that in some sense made them distinctive in the first place. And there's a turn in this process from a kind of revolution at the beginning in the 1920s that not only could tolerate, but really was dependent on its pluralities, to the end of the 1920s, this moment of the onset of the Stalin Revolution, where there's an increasingly universalizing political tendency, where all of these sort of other forms of politics that had percolated at the beginning of the revolution are being suppressed. But simultaneously, there's a certain type of turn to a type of social uniformity, where the types of forms of Jewish social production, wherein in the workshops, in these small artisanal shops, is being eradicated in the process of the Stalin Revolution, because the Stalin Industrial Revolution is effectively trying to not eradicate but subsume these types of smaller forms of production into a much, much more vast project of overarching socialist industrial reconstruction. And Jews are, in some sense, like all people in the society, are faced with this moment of whether they're going to fight against it or whether they're, in some sense, going to fold themselves into it. And it's this process of folding themselves into, and really, by the end of the 1920s, that's the only choice that's left, because in some sense, the state is there, and the state is by this point massive. The party has consolidated itself. And so I see this moment of folding into this kind of universalist discourse of the Stalin Revolution as the end of what I call the Jewish Revolution, but also the beginning the continuation of a type of integration that is inherent in the revolution from the beginning. And that's a painful process. It's a process that produces all sorts of tensions within the Jewish community. But it ultimately, especially if one looks at it within the context of what's happening across Central and Eastern Europe in this period, you know, this is of tremendous consequence for Jews living within the Soviet Union. The fact that the Stalinist state is launching a campaign against anti-Semitism in the context of rising anti-Semitism, obviously in Germany, but across Eastern Europe. Yes, it in some sense is a manipulative campaign and double-sided, as I call it. But at the same time, there's also a real content there. And this has profound effects for thinking about what happens in the Soviet Union during the 1930s and the 1940s as well. But so I would say those are the sort of big claims. But the other big claim is that throughout this process, Jewish identity and social and political identity is constantly being negotiated and restructured in moments that are profoundly themselves structured by economic processes and economic crises. Moments of economic crises produce ambivalences about Jews that are not simply, I mean, we see this obviously in the context of Central and Eastern Europe. What fascinates me about this story is that this is happening in the Soviet Union, in a society that understands itself as post-capitalist, in a society that understands itself as post-racist. And even there, these types of social pressures these types of ideological forms are emerging out of social crises that are being unleashed across the totality of the globe, really, by the onset of the global crisis at the end of the 1920s. And it's that relationship between crisis and politics that forms the heart of the book, I would say.
Brilliant. Well, that's a really excellent summation of the main arguments of the book, and it's a really fascinating book, and I think it's a really brilliant piece of scholarship. So thanks very much for talking to us today about it, Andrew. Before we let you go, I just want to quickly ask, I know you're over in Moscow working in the archives at the moment, so I wanted to ask about what you're working on next.
Well, I'm working on two projects briefly. The first one is a project that I'm very excited about. It looks at the writing of popular history in the transnational Yiddish sphere between 1871 and 1948, and the relationship between the writing of popular history and the reimagining of both Jewish and general history, and the relationship between that and the development of Jewish internationalist socialism over that period. So that's one project that I'm working on in the libraries with lots of Yiddish pamphlets, and it's great. And then I'm simultaneously working on a project on the relationship between Stalinist anti-fascist campaigns and anti-Trotskyist campaigns in the 1930s and their relationship to the Great Terror, and that I'm working on in the archives here in Moscow.
That's brilliant. Well, we hope to definitely have you on the program again to hopefully talk about those projects. Thank you very much for coming on and talking to us about this book. So with us today, we had Andrew Sloan, Assistant Professor of History at the Baruch College at the City University of New York, and he talked to us about his new book, The Jewish Revolution in Belorussia, Economy, Race, and Bolshevik Power, and it was published this year by Indiana University Press. So thanks again.
Thank you very much.